Happy Holidays from Word Balloon, the comics conversation site. This is John Suntress. Today, a conversation with the legendary artist Neil Adams. You could say the Bronze Age of comic books began when Neil took over drawing heroes like the Spectre and Deadman, or his redesign of Batman in The Brave and Bold. The illustrator jumped to Marvel with great but short-lived classic runs on the X-Men and the Avengers. His collaborations with Denny O'Neil on Batman and Green Lantern Green Arrow have been repackaged and republished for decades. His renditions of the DC heroes have created trademark images that have sold books, toys, calendars, lunchboxes, and dozens of other marketing applications for decades. Innovations didn't end with just his artwork. Adams pushed DC forward to reinvent methods of coloring and printing in its production department. Throughout the years, he's championed creator rights as a vocal advocate for causes like the credit and compensation package for Siegel and Schuster on Superman. His most ambitious fight is still getting started in the fields of science, where Neil has bold theories regarding the creation of the universe. Before you mock him, listen and watch the film clips he hosts at his website, neiladams.com. Any layman can understand and appreciate his theories, which question the foundations of accepted geological science. The site also showcases Neil's views on current events, plus several new art designs and story ideas of Neil's favorite characters. Let's hope some of these will see publication, because Adams is back in the comics mainstream, with new collections of his masterworks and new projects for both DC and Marvel. Our conversation begins with the 1960s Adams enjoying success as a newspaper illustrator on Ben Casey, the medical soap opera strip based on the popular television series. Coming from your experiences on Bat Masterson and Ben Casey doing the syndicated strip and going to DC looking for stories to work on, it seems you had already achieved what a lot of the comic book artists back then were trying to do, and that's land a syndicated comic strip deal.
Yeah.
So did that put you in a more confident position when it came to trying to get these comic book gigs?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I had really had no intent at that point in my career to, quote, go backward and to do comic books. My intention was, since I had a syndicated strip, since it was successful, it was in 165 papers across the country and around the world, why would I want to go and do comic books? It doesn't even make sense logically, and certainly not from the point of view of making a living. What I wanted to do at that point was to go on and either do another comic strip or to become an illustrator. And since I had sufficient ability to become an illustrator, I did a portfolio, took 6 months off, and I made a portfolio. I left it at an advertising agency, and when I went back to get it a couple of days later, it was gone. So I was stuck illustrator sans portfolio.
Okay.
So I thought, well, you know, I'm doing advertising work, but it's really not as much as I, you know, need to do to keep body and soul together and support my family, because advertising work is sporadic.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, maybe, you know, that thing that I sort of wanted to do, but I kind of did it another way, maybe I can pick up some comic book work. And I looked around and I noted that this company called Warren that used to do Famous Monsters of Filmland is branching out doing these creepy, eerie, and Vampirella comic books.
Mm-hmm.
At that time it was creepy and eerie. So I brought my samples up to see Archie Goodwin, who was then in charge, and he gave me a script. I mean, it didn't take him long, handed me a script, and that's what I started to do. I started to do monster stories. And it was very good for me because all that angst that I had built up doing illustration work, I was able to vent on these stories. So each story that I did for Archie was essentially different from the previous story. In other words, I created a new technique or a new way of doing it for each story that I did. One was done in wash, one was done in magic marker, one was done in pencil, one was done in a design concept that was different from other design concepts. So essentially, I got to play. After a while, I realized, well, this is very nice for Neil, but it's not really putting bread on the table. Maybe I ought to get some work that I can, quote, crank out, phrases that we use in comic books that we're so ashamed of. Hack and crank out. So I can hack some pages out and crank some pages out and make a living. So I went over to DC Comics, and I spoke to the fellow that did the comic books that I respected the most. That was the War comic books by Bob Kaniger.
Mm-hmm.
War comic books are good in that you can reference, and you can reference as much as you want. You can get a little crazy and do sort of adventurous stuff compared to the stuff that was being done in those days which was pretty mild and pretty vanilla. And so I started to do war stories, but then, I don't know, I got, like, attracted to, oh, some of the higher-class comic books, like Jerry Lewis comic books and Bob Hope comic books.
That's what's amazing, because given your realistic style, you're cranking, as you say, pages out on these very cartoony books that modern readers could probably compare to the Archie style.
Yes, and in fact, there's a thing, there's a conversation that I would have with Will Eisner. It had to do with what we call Bigfoot and Littlefoot comics.
Mm-hmm.
Bigfoot comics, of course, are cartoon comic books, we know, where characters have big feet.
Mm-hmm.
Littlefoot comic books are superheroes, you know, have little tiny feet but big muscular bodies. If you go to the people who are the best, pretty much they'll agree that if you don't have Bigfoot training, you might as well not do the Littlefoot stuff either, because you're just going to be stiff and boring. Bigfoot training allows you to see the extreme of action, allows you to see things that you would never see as a Littlefoot guy. There's lots of guys that draw Littlefoot comic books that are stiff, you know, people standing at attention constantly, you know, with their muscles flexed.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't understand the animation of a Bigfoot drawing. And so to fall into a situation at DC Comics where I was trying to make a living and to be presented with the possibility of doing Bob Hope and Jerry Lewis comic books for somebody else may have seemed to be very odd and strange and something to avoid. For me, it was not, because I could pencil 10 pages in a day.
Wow.
To be perfectly honest, in comic books, that's the best money I ever made. doing Jerry Lewis and Bob Hope comic books, I could crank those babies out. I could pencil 10 pages a day. I could ink 10 pages a day. I don't think I could do more than 2 pages of regular comic books, regular Littlefoot comic books.
And that's fast.
That's pretty fast.
Yeah.
But to be perfectly honest, it was fun. And, you know, given a choice today, if you catch me in the right mood, you know, I'd be delighted to sit down and do a Bigfoot comic book. And periodically in my regular business, I get to do such things.
Yes.
I have things that I do for some commercial clients that are very Bigfoot-oriented, and I just have a ball. So I'm not one of those serious artists. You know, it's hard to catch me in a serious mood. I really don't. I don't take it very seriously, and I figure, well, if somebody's going to pay me to do pictures, to draw pictures, then I'm pretty much in heaven, aren't I?
And your versatility is evident on your website as well, because you do show some of the cartoons that you've done for advertising.
Oh, yeah, you see that Nazan XB, I think, mm-hmm. is probably on my website. And I don't think you can get too much more cartoony than that. But I enjoy all of these things. Anyway, I got to do other stuff at DC, and I kind of played around. I did Elongated Man, and I did the war stuff and Jerry Lewis. Then I did Brave and Bold stuff, where I got to play with Batman after being turned down by the Batman editor.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And thinking back now that you were turned down, and, you know, well, at least they did give you Brave and Bold, because that's what I first saw as a very small kid.
Yes. Well, in fact, I think if Julius Schwartz could have gotten up from his desk and kicked me out of his office, he would have done when I asked to do Batman. But I didn't think he did it. I mean, I've always got along with Julius Schwartz, the editor of the Batman books. But mm-hmm. to be perfectly honest, he was working under a constrained condition where he had to follow the way the license was written, and he could only hire certain people, and he could only do it a certain way. So he just didn't let me do it.
There wasn't room for you, because was the work still being split up between Carmine Infantino and the Kane studio of guys like Robinson? And
well, actually, no. I mean, Robinson had long before left. He actually became a real artist, unlike the rest of us. No, Carmine was no longer doing Batman. He was doing actually Dead Man at that point.
I think
he was sick of doing Batman.
Okay.
So they were back to the Bob Kane stuff,
okay.
which, to be perfectly honest, just wasn't very good. And much of it followed the old TV show.
Yes.
So besides being, you know, losing Carmine Infantino, following the old TV show was ridiculous, because you had Batman walking down the street in the middle of the daytime in his costume and people not commenting that there was a man in his long underwear with a long cape on walking down the street. Mommy, isn't that weird? The kind of thing that really makes the character smaller in the eyes of the reading public. So I had no interest in doing that Batman. I certainly had an interest in doing, you know, the Batman. That's what I wanted to do. So Julie didn't let me do it. So I went over to Brave and Bold, and I asked Murray Boltonoff, who was the editor, who was very mellow and would be pretty much delighted with anything that I would do for him because we just had a great relationship. After all, I was doing Bob Hope and Jerry Lewis for him.
Okay, there you go.
I asked if I could work on Brave and Bold, which included Batman as one of the characters in the book. Might as well be a Batman book. And I started to do these stories, and I said, look, the only I don't want to change the stories. I said, but if I can just do this, Murray, anything that takes place in the daytime, I'd rather have take place at night. And I like to have a little flexibility and, you know, moving panels around to make sure that the story gets told a little bit more adventurously.
Mm-hmm.
So he was fine, no problem. So I started to do Brave and Bold, and after a couple of months, I guess fans started to write letters to Julie Schwartz asking him how come the only Batman at DC Comics was in Brave and Bold.
and you had some, like, resistance from Bob Haney, the writer of Brave and Bold, didn't you? Because
I was aware of.
Oh, okay.
We got along great.
Because clearly not only did you redesign Batman, but even things like Green Arrow.
Well, Bob Haney was you have to remember that even though I'm known for working with Denny O'Neill, if you look
yes.
at those Brave and Bold stories, you will see an abundance of story in each one of those. Very, very full and thick storytelling and good stories.
Absolutely.
So it was a pleasure to be working on those stories, and my relationship with Bob Haney was quite terrific. I didn't change anything. In fact, it was sort of Bob Haney's idea to update and revamp Green Arrow. He didn't quite know what to do with it. He said, you know, he ought to be, you know, we're going to present him again. Let's revamp him a little bit. But he didn't quite know what I had in mind. I didn't know I had in mind to turn him into rather more of an Errol Flynn type of Robin
mm-hmm.
Hood. But he, as far as he was concerned, that was just great. We had a, you know, there were. I actually never had a bad word with Bob Haney in my whole time with him.
I appreciate the correction because, it didn't make sense to me because I thought I had read that there was a problem and that you were even taken off of Brave and Bold, but that didn't make sense because you had subsequent issues.
No, I think that in fact, if they could have kept me on Brave and Bold for as long as they could, they probably would have done it. I think Bob Brown continued after I did, but what happened was that Julie Schwartz attacked me in the hallway and insisted that I was destroying Batman. But since I was destroying it, I ought to do it in the Batman comic book rather than Brave and Bold. So he purloined me from Brave and Bold to do Batman in the Batman comic books.
And you and Denny O'Neill just, you know, hit the ground running with that.
It was kind of a surprise that that worked out so well. But Denny had been a reporter previously,
mm-hmm.
so his grounding was a little less fanciful than you might find in a regular comic book writer. And because of that, his stories tended to be a little grittier and tended to be less, you know, it's the Riddler hopping around telling riddles.
Sure.
Even when we agreed that we would bring the Joker back, the Joker was a rather deadly character and
mm-hmm.
would laugh and tell jokes, but usually blow people up while he did it. So Denny's contribution was to, thankfully, from my point of view, to include the grittiness that I had begun in Brave and Bold, but to also do that to the story. So it was very cool.
Let's jump back for a second to Deadman, because as you say, Infantino did that first book,
yeah.
and then you took over and really remade the character, redesigned the book, and again, that's just one of those early memories that I have of first being exposed to your work and just saying, what is this? And it was so different. And the leap from what Arnold Drake and Infantino did, you know, Jack Miller is credited as the scripter. Were you writing the books?
I was writing the books after a time, because there was a lot of politics going on at DC Comics, something that I avoid scrupulously as much as I can because I have my own problems. I don't think, in my mind, I think of what I do as grander politics, not, you know, infighting politics.
I see. Okay.
I don't do that. But, you know, if you have a cause and you need somebody to put a helmet on and get on a horse and, like an idiot, ride into the battle, that's what I do.
Okay.
But I don't get involved in that kind of stuff that happens around offices. And that seemed to be what was going on. Miller came into conflict with some folks up there, and he ended up having to leave. Arnold was I guess for whatever reason, was there was some talk that DC Comics had some certain freelance writers that wanted to get together and organize for better rates and for better things.
Yes.
At that time, I can recall one conversation that I had with Arnold, in which he said, took me aside, and he said, look, you know, how do you feel about organizing to, you know, fight against various things that the comic book companies are doing? I said, well, gee, I just sort of got here. I don't exactly know what you're talking about, and I believe in unionism and all that stuff, but I that seems like a far jump. Well, whatever the hell I said, he lost faith that I would become a compatriot. Which, considering my actions later on, is a little strange.
Yeah, no kidding. That is surprising.
Had he been straightforward and said, look, a bunch of us guys are getting together to do this and we want to do that, I probably would have said, oh, fine, we'll do that. I'll knock some doors down for you. But he didn't say that. It was a very kind of, I couldn't even understand what he was driving at.
Okay.
Not that I'm stupid, but I'm really not that smart. I essentially said, you know, I think that things should be writer, but I basically don't quite understand what you're driving at. So I have a feeling that Arnold ran into some resistance from the company, you know?
Yeah.
That's not my style.
I don't
do it that way. I just, you know, we sit down and have a cup of coffee, and I say, you know, why don't you return the original art? You know, would be better, wouldn't it? Don't you think, instead of ripping it up and throwing it away? How about that?
Yeah, you're not a bad cop. You're a good cop. I understand.
I think that's a better way of doing things.
Sure.
You get a lot more done. Because then you can always have another conversation. Nobody's pissed at you.
Right, right.
You know, people didn't, you know, if people get pissed at me, but they get pissed at me behind my back or someplace else, that's okay. But straight to my face, they pretty much act okay.
Okay.
So I'm good. So I think there was some problem with Arnold there, although I wasn't totally aware of it, but it didn't seem like he was doing Deadman. It seemed like Miller was doing it. Then Miller got into trouble. Then what happened was, it was sort of like somebody, you know, went in the room and threw numbers up in the air, and anybody who could grab one could write a Deadman story. So Kaniger wrote a Deadman story. He wrote a story that took place over two books. Bob has a way of writing. And since I was a kid in school, I know Bob Kaniger's way of writing. What you do is you set up a problem, and then you have the good guy try to deal with it, and they can't deal with it, and he fails. And then you set it up again, and he tries to deal with it, and he fails. And then the third time out, while he's failing, he figures it out, and then he succeeds. Personally, I'd rather skip the first two times.
Okay.
I think, you know, if you can sort of get the idea, you know, you don't have to put those extra ones in there. So Bob did a story that was the length of two books.
Okay.
And I cut it down to one, and it worked out terrifically. But Dick Giordano became the editor because he was thrown the book, I guess, while Miller was on his way out. And so I sat with him and I said, look, you know, I'd like to take a shot at writing the book because it seems to be flying off in many directions, and it seems to me that this character deserves a little bit more attention. Dick said, well, show me what you have in mind. I showed him. And he said, fine, go ahead. So after Kaniger, I believe, I did the rest of the books and did the rest of the writing on the book. And to everybody's happiness, it seemed.
Well, obviously, yeah, because, you know, decades later, they're still, you know, repackaging it and then presenting it. I really enjoyed, too, in the 80s when they brought it back and you did all the new, or you did a lot of new covers. I know you had one that was the scene from the Brave and Bold moment with the hook. But no, it really was, because all of a sudden you had these other moments of the story. And you were given the opportunity to kind of, you know, bring those visions to light. They were great.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's some, one of these days, somebody's going to come and say, how'd you like to do, you know, a 4-issue miniseries with Deadman? And I'll say probably yes.
See, and that's another great thing about your website, too, is that you've got a lot of, I think, plot teases up there. And I read the one for Green Lantern. I think that's intriguing as well. I hope you get a chance to do it.
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, are you, you know, I was going to ask about this anyway, but we're in the subject now. Are you talking to both of the big houses in terms of doing more work? I know you did a little Marvel work, obviously, this year.
I talked to the writer of Green Lantern, and he seemed very receptive, but I really haven't had any follow-up on that, so I don't know what's going on with that.
Okay.
But he seemed very receptive.
Well, he's got a lot on his plate right now, Geoff Johns.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's running that whole Infinite Crisis deal. And
yeah.
What do you think of the big company-wide crossover things like that?
Well, I think they're okay. you know, if you do too many characters all at once, it sort of becomes a circus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's okay for the geeks. All right, everyone out there who's a geek, you know
everyone's
who you
laughing.
Are. You know, please, let's not pretend. We all know. And I think that's great. And I'm not a geek. I'm a little geeky. I'll say this. I'm a geeky maybe about science and about, you know, certain things, but I'm not that kind of a geek.
Okay.
So I don't really personally enjoy those things, but I can see the appeal. I'm mm-hmm. not a fool. I can recognize, you know, that there's fans out there who know everything before everybody else and will discuss infinite crisis on infinite universes and infinite planets and who's dead and who's alive here and all the rest of it. I'm just totally shocked that people can keep track of that stuff. I, for the life of me, I couldn't do it. I would rather a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that it doesn't have to interconnect with any and everything. So it's not my thing. It's other people's thing, and there are people who are much smarter than I that do this sort of stuff, and I think it's great. I just don't do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that they do it, and every once in a while, one of my kids will grab me and say, "Hey, this is cool," you know. And,
sure.
And I'll give it a try, and if I can manage, you know, through three or four issues, I'll read it. Like I thought the one that was done by Rags Morales.
Yeah, Identity Crisis.
Yeah.
With Brad Meltzer.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
Because it did seem to contain itself, and it didn't fly off into too many different things. And so I enjoyed it. I also enjoyed Rags' artwork. I thought that for the first time, people are really recognizing Rags Morales as a real solid contributor to the comic book business.
So, you bet.
For that reason alone, but I did enjoy the series, and my son and I would trade notes on it. Dad, you know who died, right? Was that the elongated man's wife? Yes.
That's too much. Did Rags work for you at Continuity?
No, not really. I just sort of, we run into each other now and then, and I've always encouraged him, and there's a lot of what you call sons of Neil Adams out there that we just,
indeed,
you know, we bump into each other now and then.
and certainly there were contemporaries as well that seemed to take your style and use it as a starting point.
I don't know if they were contemporary. I think that they were later. The thing about Neil's contemporaries, if we can speak about them,
please,
for a moment, is there aren't any.
I can appreciate that, certainly.
At the time that I got into comic books, nobody was getting into comic books. In fact, I don't know of anybody outside of perhaps Jim Steranko, who was a magician.
Right.
For a long time, who actually got into comic books at the time that I, or that is anywhere within my age, 5 years on either side.
Yeah, I was thinking of Aparo.
Aparo, I believe, is quite a bit older.
Okay, yeah.
But he worked for Charlton for quite a long time. I don't know. I would have to check into it. That's the first time that was mentioned. Now you pique my curiosity.
Okay. No,
I would only because Jim died.
Right.
Maybe that's incorrect for me to think that he was quite a bit older.
No, and he was, and you're right. He did do the Charlton work as well. It just seemed that once your Batman, for example, was established, that was the look for Batman. And maybe guys weren't drawing as much like you before then. But
yeah,
certainly, you know, your Batman was the template of the 70s.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, Vic.
What do you know, the 70s? Hold on. up until now, I think until that movie, the movie that just came out.
That's true.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
No,
I understand.
It's back and forth with Batman, but pretty much that's the Batman that we know and love. I mean.
Well, the group of contemporaries I was thinking of was in that 70s decade. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah,
of.
No, but, and I know. And I would call them copiers.
Well, yeah. You know, well, and again, was that editorially driven?
All I'm saying is that they recognized what it was that I was doing. They realized that if they did that, they could make a living
mm-hmm.
more easily, and so they did it, and they liked it. And they were, you know, all those guys were fans of mine.
Sure.
And very, very positive fans. I think the ones, though, that you have to recognize a little bit more are people who did what I did and then took it one step further. In other words, did their version of my version.
No, I understand what you mean.
And those people didn't necessarily do it in my style, but they did my Batman in their style. Whereas Jim Aparo and Irv Novick basically just did my Batman.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
All of which is all very complimentary and wonderful, either way you go. But right then, when that happened, since I couldn't be five people, then DC was quite happy to have three or four other people that could
capture that.
A reasonable range, be Neil as well as Neil was.
And again, yeah, I was wondering, was that editorially driven, or was it the artist saying, hey, this is working, let's all...
I think it was sort of like the tide, you know? It pretty much was there.
Okay.
I don't think anybody drew back from it, you know? I think everybody's really relieved to get out of that.
Yeah.
You know, the show was great. I tell you, I love that show. But it was epitomized by, as I understand, in my mind, by, I think it was Jill St. John, who was on top of this cyclotron that managed to sit on a soundstage, and somehow she fell into the, quote, cyclotron, which you got the feeling that you could move if you gave it a shove across the stage. And Batman said, oh, what a way to go-go. And I thought, well, I mean, that's sort of that. Says what that show is.
Right, it's a farce.
It's a farce.
Yeah.
It's a satire. And sufficiently fun and wonderful for the time, but if you're reading Batman comic books, that's not what you want to see.
No, and in fact, the show itself was short-lived in terms of its popularity as well, and only made it to, like, the 2.5 seasons or something
like
that.
Well, although it was tremendously popular. Nobody really missed that show the first 2 years. Maybe the third year, people got a little bit tired of it because you couldn't do so many costumed idiots. I mean, once you got
Vincent Price.
Who's that big guy who played the Pharaoh in the...
Oh, King Tut, Victor Bruno.
After a while, you know, it got to be a little bit...
Too much, man.
Here's Neil making fun of that character while, you know, at the same time, there's the Penguin and the Joker and all the rest of it. It was all pretty silly.
You know, you mentioned Steranko. Was he the guy that kind of gave you the idea of trying to go to Marvel?
Well, he did, in the sense that he came over to visit me after I did this thing in Deadman. I mean, there was a certain, there is a certain professional recognition. I'm sure that Jim Steranko saw my stuff, and I certainly saw Jim Steranko's stuff. And so I did this little gag in a Deadman story where I was doing certain optical effects, and there's this panel where you have steam coming up from the bottom of the panel, and Deadman is looking down to this pit where the steam is coming up. And if you take the comic book and you hold it at an angle, a very steep angle, and you look at the steam, it turns into letters, and it says, hey, a Jim Steranko effect. Which clearly got to Jim at some point, and Jim came over to DC Comics and paid me a visit and pointed out that he was able to recognize it along with everybody else in the world. And we got to bullshit for a while, and
sure.
He turned out to be a really nice fella, as most people in comic books are. I don't really know too many bad people in comic books.
That's cool.
And we talked about Marvel, and I said, well, exactly how do you do, your work at Marvel? And he said, well, I just do a story, and I give it to Stan, and he, dialogues it, puts in the words. I said, that's interesting. We don't do that here. Gee, I'd kind of like to give that a try. So I went over to Marvel to do a book in the Marvel style. And at the same time, remember, there was things going on in the business, like when artists would switch from one company to another, they would change their name.
Yes. Adam Austin was Gene Colan.
Right. And Mickey Demio, I believe, was a name for Ross Andrews' partner.
Oh, Mike Esposito.
Mike Esposito changed his name. So they would change their names as if somehow there was an edict from above, which didn't exist, but somehow it saved, embarrassment or somebody looking at them with an arched eyebrow or, something that would be bad.
Because you guys were all freelance, too, so there shouldn't really have been an issue.
No, and so I thought maybe I figured out a nice simple way to crack that. So when I went over to Marvel, I spoke to Stan, and Stan was very, very gregarious and nice, and he said, what do you want to work on? I said, well, are you sure? Do you know who I am? What do I do? He says, listen, Deadman is the only DC Comics that the guys around here read.
Wow. Wow.
He says, well, okay. He says, anything you want to do, you can do. I said, well, what's your worst-selling title? And Stan said, we really want you to work on the Fantastic Four or Spider-Man. I said, yeah, but what's your worst selling title? So Stan said, well, X-Men, we're going to cancel it in 2 issues. I said, oh, well, I'd like to do X-Men. And Stan said, well, and you know, all the while thinking, you know, the Marvel style, you know, total freedom.
Right.
I said, well, Stan, if I do the X-Men and you're going to cancel in a couple of issues, you pretty much aren't going to pay much attention to it. He said, well, that's true. I said, well, then I'd like to do the X-Men. So he said, I'll tell you what, I'll make you a deal. He says, you do the X-Men, we cancel it in 2 issues, then we give you a really important title, like the Avengers, to do. I said, sure. Now, if you put that in context, that's pretty funny. Well, so anyway, I did the X-Men.
Yeah.
And it turns out it was so low on Stan's totem pole that he wasn't writing it. Roy Thomas was writing it.
Yes.
He was dialoguing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked with Roy for, we did 10 issues, and then they canceled it.
So obviously did something must have gone right for it to extend to 10 issues rather than just the 2.
I think they just decided that, you know, that it was looking good, and it was getting a lot of attention. It was certainly getting a lot of attention, my goodness. It got a tremendous amount of attention. Another one of those books that gets reprinted constantly.
Yes. And that's, you know, I wanted to ask about that because a lot of your famous runs are like that, short-lived, and books that were on the verge of cancellation.
Mm-hmm.
You guys come in, you and Denny at DC, and you and Roy at Marvel, in the case of the X-Men, you redesign things, get everyone excited, and then the books get canceled. Yet they're considered classics, and then are reprinted and repackaged for decades.
You probably don't even want to know how and why that happens, right?
I'm a little curious.
Well, I'll tell you. It's a little boring, but I'll go as fast as I can.
Okay.
What they have is what they call distribution. Distribution means that what you do is you print your comic book and you send it to the distributor. In the case of the newsstand, not the comic book stores, but in the case of the newsstand,
right,
which is the stores and the mom-and-pop stores,
yep,
and the newsstand, you have national distributors. You have a national distributor, and then you have local distributors. At that time, there were approximately 440 local distributors. Now
okay,
there's more like, 180, something like that. All of those controlled a certain area, and they would distribute your comic books or your magazines or whatever in those areas.
Right.
But the magazine and comic book distribution business had declined over time.
Mm-hmm.
And originally, they used to have what they called returns.
If right,
they didn't sell your comic books, they would return whatever comic copies they didn't sell. In the 50s, they came up with this idea, why don't we give strip comic books back? Well, what did that mean? What that mean was that they would take the top of your magazine that they got back, they were going to destroy and send back to you, and they'd strip the title off with a razor cutter,
mm-hmm,
and they would package those stripped titles off and send them back to you, and they would destroy the magazines. Now, when I was a kid in Coney Island, there was a toy store that was nearby us, and I could go in and buy those comic books.
Yep, me too.
And they would have the top stripped off. Some of them would be stripped off badly. Some of them would be stripped off not so badly. But since they sold for 2 and 3 cents,
you didn't care.
From my point of view, I didn't care.
Nope.
I could get all the comic books I wanted. And I was on a very limited budget. Very limited budget. So I could get and read the comic books. What that meant was, I don't know exactly how to put this the right way, it meant that distributors were dishonest.
Yeah.
yes, that's what it meant. Because they said, well, we'll strip the tops off and we'll send them in, but why do we have to throw these away if some stupid kid is going to buy it for 2 or 3 cents?
Sure.
So they did that. Now that's in the real world. Now in the fake world, a business where they don't know shit, excuse expression.
No, you can say what you want. It's the Internet.
They decided, well, you know, getting these titles, that was ridiculous. We didn't really need to do that. Why don't we make another deal? Why don't we have a thing called affidavit returns? Affidavit returns means, as the local distributor, since I've proved my honesty, I'm going to sign a piece of paper that says I destroyed 500 copies of these. And you'll believe it.
Sure.
And everybody went along with it. So, naturally, sales declined precipitously.
Okay.
Now, you weren't selling 70% of your print run, you were selling 50% of your print run.
Right.
And you scratch your head and say, jeez, I wonder why. Now we're selling 40% of our print run. I don't understand why. Well, what happened in comic books was you had people like Phil Suling around the country who knew that they had fans that they could supply comic books to on a fan market. There wasn't a real fan market. There weren't comic book stores.
Right, right.
But there were get-togethers.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the conventions.
Guys would rent a room in a hotel or whatever, and they'd have their comic books stacked, and they would get together with other fans, and they trade, and they buy comic books. And certain guys were smart enough to get extra copies of certain comic books. Now, how would they do that? Would they get it from their local store? I mean, they'd have 100 copies of, let's say, Strange Adventures, Dead Man. Now, you can't go to your local store and get 100 copies because they only have 10. So where are you going to get 100 copies? Well, you go to your local distributor, and they have what they call a back door. It's called a loading ramp. And so what you do is you set up a table next to the loading ramp, and you take your little van in, and you go inside, and those comic books that are supposed to be destroyed, you go and you make a deal, and you pay 30% for those comic books, and they mark them as being destroyed.
Wow.
Now, what happens at that time is more and more of those guys are going around making those purchases in every city in America.
Mm-hmm.
So there's 440 distributors, so you got guys, maybe not all in, you know, all 440, but you certainly, after a while, it catches on. You got one smart guy in every city, smart enough to go up to the local distributor and make the deal, unless he's a jerk. So he goes and he buys a given number of copies that he knows he's got customers for. Now, let's say you're one of those guys, and along comes Barry Windsor Smith, along comes Jim Steranko, along comes Neil Adams, turning out comic books. What ones are you going to go buy?
Yep.
Well, you buy the other ones, but more and more you're going to buy those, and you're going to buy those, and you're going to sell them to your favorite buddies. Now, those are going to be affidavit returned as being destroyed.
Right.
All across America. So here you have Marvel and DC Comics. They know they have popular comics. They know kids are writing fan letters. Everybody's going nuts. Neil Adams is doing Batman. Jim Steranko's doing S.H.I.E.L.D.
Mm-hmm.
Barry Windsor Smith is starting to do Conan.
Yep.
Everybody's going crazy. Still, the sales aren't doing well. They're not going up one bit. In fact, some of them are dropping. How is that possible? Ooh, I don't know. That can't be happening.
Wow.
Well, let me tell you this. Two interesting facts. I go to comic book conventions, and I sign today mint condition copies of every one of those comic books that I ever did. Mint condition copies.
Unbelievable.
That people are pulling out of boxes and selling on the comic book market, but now they're selling them for $20 and $30 and $40. That's a pretty good investment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Second fact. I used to do, when I was at DC Comics, I used to do covers. I did a lot of covers for DC Comics.
Yeah,
but
that's an
understatement. But the insides weren't that good.
Uh-huh.
Let's just call a spade a spade.
Sure.
The insides just weren't that good. Fact is that those comic books went up 10 points in sales. Why did that happen? Well, those guys that went to the back of the distributor, they knew that, yes, Neil Adams may have done the cover, but nobody's going to buy that comic book just because Neil did that cover, although there are some fans who will, who may, you know, be geeky enough to buy the cover.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not going to buy 100 copies like they will a Batman. So they kind of left those comic books alone. So they went through the regular process, and therefore they went up in sales. So all the comic books that I did covers for, but I didn't do the insides, went up 10 points. All the ones that I did either stayed the same or went down.
Wow. And that informed them to keep you as a cover artist then? And not
to keep you as a cover artist and then cancel Strange Adventures.
Wow. Unbelievable. That's really cool. Because, yeah, I was going to ask if that was a choice on your part as far as not doing as many interiors rather than moving to covers as you did as time went on.
Well, I did covers simply because they expressed the need and the want. They didn't come to me and say, hat in hand, and say, will you please do covers or else Marvel's going to kick our ass? But they did... They did ask me to do covers, and I felt I was making a contribution to DC Comics at the time, and I was also helping to bring in new young artists, because they had a very bad policy at DC. They had a very bad policy at Marvel, but it was worse at DC Comics. They weren't really letting people through the door, and you really had to commit superheroic stunts to bring people in. I would have to bring people in and hide them. And say, here's a good artist. You ought to be using him. Oh, I haven't got a book for him. All my books are assigned. No, they're not assigned. And you have backup features, and you can use them, and you ought to give them a try. Come on, pay attention here. Marvel is kicking our ass. And after a while, then a slightly more open-door policy evolved at DC Comics. But at the beginning, when I got there, boy, the door was locked, closed and locked.
Well, sure. And I'm sure they were still smarting from the 50s as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So everyone wanted to protect their territory, and I'm sure it was a closed door. And
exactly. It was terrible. When I first went to DC Comics when I got out of high school, they never even let me into the out of the lobby, into the show my work. And the guy who came out just apologized and said, "Look, young man, your work is actually very, very good. Another time, but really this is a very bad business to be in. I can't even bring your work in. I can't even show it to any. I just want to go in and show it to no, I'm sorry. Can't do it."
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, are we cool for time?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. Superman versus Ali.
See, that's what happens when you get started in a conversation.
But this is good.
It's getting very thick.
Let's talk about Superman versus Ali.
Yes.
One of my favorites.
In my opinion, the greatest comic book ever done. If I'm allowed to include my work with everybody else's, and people will forgive this, you know, an ego that may be out of control. I try not to do that, but from my point of view, at the comic book, that beginning to end represents what comic books ought to be about: Superman versus Muhammad Ali.
It's a great book. It goes from the inner city to outer space.
Yep.
I'm a huge.
How clever you are to say that.
But it does. and I cover boxing in my day job in sports radio, and have to tell you that
three-time champion.
And also, by the time it was released, in between that third title,
he lost to one again.
Yeah, but it was Leon Spinks, so we all knew he would eventually get it back, hopefully. First of all, the fight is itself a great scene.
Thank you. And
a great series of panels.
I love fights in there.
That's true. I'm talking specifically the Ali Superman fight. Just the little things like Perry and Jimmy working his corner.
Yeah.
that image of the pummeled Supes being carried out of the ring.
Yeah.
Just great stuff. Was there obviously Ali is his own, you know, model in terms of how you designed and had Ali moving. But as far as Superman's fighting in the ring, were there fighters that you thought of in terms of style?
No, and in fact, you're probably much more aware of fighters than I am. I'm not as aware of fighters. I'm aware of the fictional side of fighters, and there's certain things that inspire me. And one of them, oddly enough, not a fighting thing, but a story by Bob Kaniger about a character that he did about a boxer who wouldn't go down.
Yep.
And I thought, you know, that's one of the best images I've ever seen in fiction and any kind of medium. And I thought, that's a great thing to do. You know, that I'm, and you know, if I could put a little plaque on that sequence, that's the plaque it would read. It would dedicate it to Bob Kaniger.
That's cool.
But this idea of a guy having that much grit that his body would stay up after his mind is gone, practically, that he would not go down, he would stay up and then have the other fighter then back off and say, "No, sorry, I'm not going to do this. I won. That's enough. I'm not going to knock him down." I think that, to me, it's sort of like a fictional character compared to a real character.
Sure.
And I didn't want to go to anybody's style. I didn't want to, like, oh, let me study so-and-so's style. That, to me, it was Ali. It was about Ali. It wasn't about Superman. Superman was my foil, and he could be, you know, another Ali or any other boxer, but it was Ali and the way he fought and the way he did things. And I would have put in more, you know, if I had more pages, I would have put in the rope-a-dope stuff and all that.
You nailed Ali's persona as well. I mean, you really had him, as I say, in the inner city. I mean, you know, talking to kids and stuff, the way he really was doing it at the time. I mean,
well,
it was great.
I'm a blushing fan of Muhammad Ali, not because I think that he's brilliant, not because I think that there are things about him that make him better than anybody else, but except that he came at a time when it was important to stand up for certain things and to be something and to be it beyond what you are in the ring. And he did it. And to give you an example, there's a it's really a small example, but I did a cover for ESPN magazine and they were deciding who was going to be the 100 greatest athletes of the century. And I did a cover for them, which was a copy of the cover that I did for Superman Muhammad Ali, and I had Ali fighting Jordan.
Yep.
And I think it's one of the best pieces of art that I've ever done. I also have a piece inside, and it's about Ali. It's a double-page spread on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And And I was glad they gave it to me, and I think probably I would have been very upset had they not given it to me to do. But when they voted at the ESPN magazine, whoever the jerks were that voted, they voted Jordan to be number one. Now, on a personal basis, I think Michael Jordan's a great guy, and I think that he represents the business of sports very, very well. But between you and me and the fence post, the man gambles. Okay. And Ali, as a representative of, forget black people in America, but as a representative of human beings, mm-hmm. standing for things that he believes in, willing to make the sacrifice that it takes to do what he has to do to stand for those things and to represent Ali, is number one. There's nobody greater. So Jordan, I love, you know, my family loves Jordan, you know. What happens when Jordan makes a mess? He sticks his tongue out. I mean, I love Michael Jordan. Really, really great.
Sure.
Number one? No. Number two, maybe. Ali, number one.
Now I'm with you. Now you're preaching to the choir, and I agree. It's interesting, and you do point out the fact that both actually did lose a bit of their prime, and you point out the fact the reason why Jordan lost a little bit of his prime, quite frankly, was his gambling.
Exactly.
As opposed to Ali, who was standing on principle and really did sacrifice a lot more for a lot more people.
Well, from my point of view, and I have a very strong opinions about this, although I really try not to take too much time to express them, the hate and stuff that happens in America has done more damage to white people than it's done to black people, because it's just made them less. And black people have the right to be proud, and white people, unfortunately, have the responsibility to be ashamed. And I don't really like being ashamed, but I, you know, there's a part of me that has to say, really, 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 really wrong.
Was there concern back in the 70s when you and Denny were doing these very socially conscious, you know, stories in Green Lantern and Green Arrow? Was there nervousness? I mean, this was when the code was, you know, still...
We made fun of Vice President Agnew and President Nixon. I mean, people get upset. Some folks. The governor of Florida got upset. He sent a letter to DC Comics after we did the Spiro Agnew takeoff and... Nixon takeoff. Everybody recognized Spiro Agnew as the superintendent of this school, but nobody quite recognized the little girl. I mean, there were some people that did, as Nixon. I couldn't imagine Nixon as a little girl. But I thought the idea that she had the power and then he was using it was a very good example of Agnew and Nixon at the time. But the governor of Florida said sent a note and said, and I'm not going to name him because I don't even remember his name, and I don't think it matters. But he sent, because they have such good governors in Florida, you know. He said something to the effect that if you ever do anything like this again, we will not allow the distribution of your comic books in Florida. And I thought, this guy's pissed. Golly.
See, now, and I was thinking of the Speedy cover, because I even, in researching
this
interview...
Well, who would be mad at that? Think about it. Who's going to be mad?
Well, and I don't even mean mad.
You're not offending anybody.
Well, but again, it was certainly for what would be considered a kid's comic book.
Yeah, well...
Pretty dicey stuff.
Yeah. You know, the mayor of New York was pretty happy with that. There was a lot of people, actually, I think Carmine did a radio tour around the country based on that.
After the fact.
Yeah.
But I mean, even before. I'm saying, like, did the guys at DC say, I don't know if we want to go in here.
Well, all right. Now, you have to remember, I'll tell you the story of this, okay, and it's actually a pretty funny story.
Okay.
You have to remember that we were under the Comics Code at the time.
Yes.
And me and the Comics Code got along very nicely, because the Comics Code would say, change something, and I would change it.
Okay.
And which... a lot of people, you know, didn't. You know, they got pissed off and there got to be arguments and stuff.
Sure.
And I went down and visited the Comics Code on behalf of the Academy, and so I could understand. And, you know, we brought people down. And those guys were trying to do their job. You know, they had a code they had to follow, so they had to do certain things. And, in fact, they very often would let things slip through as long as you changed a little tweak here and there that didn't, you know, disobey the wording of the code.
Okay.
But... truthfully, it's sort of like you know, you got a vampire and you pull his teeth, you know, and he just keeps on growing new teeth. You really have to kill the vampire, put a stake through his heart. You can't really, you know, deal with him, and he'll just grow new teeth.
Okay.
So I thought, you know, we're doing these socially conscious stories. we ought to do this. So, and because we were now kind of winding down, we had done stories about things that were significant and important, and now we were getting to overpopulation, and you know, I don't know, that doesn't seem exactly where we ought to be going. This is going to have to end at some point. So I thought, well, then what the hell? So I drew that cover, and I drew it, and I inked it, finished it, and I brought it in. Nobody knew what I was doing. I brought it into Julie Schwartz, and I handed it to him, and he looked at it for, I don't know, a mini second, and it fell from his nerveless fingers to his desk, and he said, "We can't do that." "What are you doing? Are you out of your mind?" I said, "No, no, Julie, we ought to do this." He says, "You can't do that. It's against the, you can't do that. Get out of here." I said, "Well, okay." So I took it into Carmine. I showed it to Carmine, and Carmine looked at me and said, "Can we do this?" I said, "No, I don't think we can do it, Carmine." He says, "So why did you do it?" I said, "Because we ought to do it." "Huh?" So then we took it to the executives at Kinney Corporation, who then owned DC Comics. Mm-hmm. They were down the hall between Julie and Carmine. And they dropped it with nerveless fingers. And everybody pretty much dropped it. It was, like, very hot.
Sure.
So I said, "You know, guys, sooner or later we got to do a book like this." "Yeah, yeah, right, right, right. Okay, get out of here." "Really, honestly, you know, with this ought to be our next story." "No, we can't do it. It's the Comics Code." Anyway, a couple of days later, I'm over at Marvel Comics. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Whatever. I'm hanging out. And somebody comes in and goes, "You know what Stan did?" "What did Stan do?" "Stan, you know that cover, you know that story with the kid, the teenager, and he pops pills and he walks off a roof?" "Yeah." "Well, that's a drug addiction thing. And then the Comics Code sent it back, said you can't do that." "Really? It's interesting. Pops pills and walks off a roof. Not that I necessarily ever heard anybody actually do that. I suppose it's possible, but not exactly your common reaction to a drug."
"No."
"But there you go." Somebody who didn't know about drugs
exactly
might think that happened.
Exactly.
It's, you know. Anyway, that's Stan. What's Stan going to do? Stan's going to run it anyway without the code seal. Holy shit. Holy shit. Oh. Okay. So, what happens? Stan runs the cover. It had to get to, it was on deadline. It had to get out. Sure enough, it ran without the code symbol. I call up Marvel. "What's going on? What happened to the Spider-Man cover?" "Nothing. Nobody said anything?" "No." "Went to all the newsstands and just sold?" "Yeah. Nobody noticed it."
Wow.
DC Comics flips right out. Like, totally goes, they go ape, right?
Sure.
It's like, they had it. They could have done it first.
Yep.
They didn't do it. Well, within that week, whatever the hell week it was, they decided to call a meeting of the Comics Code because it's a voluntary organization.
Yes.
In other words, owned by the companies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they call a meeting of the Comics Code, and they're all meeting in secret, and they decide to rewrite the Comics Code, totally change the Comics Code, allow drug addiction to be discussed, blah, blah, blah. Nobody cares. You know, Congress isn't in session. They don't give a crap. Never did to begin with, you know. It's all, you know, smoke up somebody's ass. And they change the Comics Code. Then they come back and say, "Okay, you can do that story."
Jeez. Okay. Wow.
Yeah, but it's too late. Stan scooped you.
Well, and both do still stand, obviously, as
yes.
great
yes.
moments yes. Of really, yeah, defying the code. Well, I guess in your case, you know, rewriting the code.
Yes. So that was fun.
Yeah.
That was fun.
No, and it's an indelible image. I mean, it really is. It's,
well, I think they're probably a little bit more significant than a guy popping pills and walking off a roof.
Well, and buried within this Green Goblin story.
I don't know.
I thought it was part of that whole Gwen Stacy.
I don't know.
Regardless. No, I think that's, and again, both
are
very
significant.
It was
a little thing. The thing about it was a little thing. It wasn't really, like, significant. It's
right.
just it got Stan's dander up, and he just decided to run it without it.
Well, whereas you've got, you know, there's Roy Harper's, you know, arm. there's the syringe.
Oh, yeah. Well, we had, the thing is that, I'll tell you, we had gone, Denny and I had been asked to go and do, propose a comic book that DC Comics was going to print and give out free that fought drug addiction. The idea was to do something against drug addiction, make a contribution. And Denny and I had both gone to do some research together. We went to Phoenix House, and we had conversations with, let me see, what should we call them, junkies.
Okay.
And discussed this at length, and I was the chairman of the board of directors of our local drug addiction center in the Bronx. That was a reconverted nunnery, and you know, I would bring junkies home from Times Square and get them through some bolted doors just to get them into the sack. So we both had a little bit of experience with the drug addiction problem, and we had both written treatments for a proposed book. I have a feeling they didn't like our treatments because I think we both sort of hit the same kind of theme, and that was that it really wasn't the junkies' fault. It was really the society's fault for not having stuff for these kids to do, and that if you want to solve the problem, you sort of have to go to the society, not to the junkie, and tell them not to take drugs because that's not going to work. You really have to say, here's an example. You have a kid going to school, and he's got a miserable day in school, and he comes home, and his mom tells him, go to his room and do his homework, and he's be down for dinner. And he would just as soon sit in front of the TV and watch TV or go out with his buddies, but he can't. He's got 3 hours of homework to do. And Dad comes home, and Dad's all tired and everything, and he throws his coat on the chair, and he doesn't give a crap, pulls out a cigarette or a cigar, turns the TV on, kicks his shoes off, lets his belt out, and lets his gut hang out. And meanwhile, the kid is in his room doing 3 hours of homework. And he's basically saying, you know, how come Dad gets, you know? And Mom says, well, your father makes money. You know, he brings home the bacon. And, of course, the kid has been working all day, and he hasn't made a cent. And he looks upon this as being wrong.
Sure.
I can't imagine why he would feel that way. So he needs something to get out of it. Now, you've set up a scenario that the next dealer that comes along is going to find a really good customer.
Yep.
Why isn't there some interrelationship between Dad and son when they come home? Why isn't there activities for these kids to have something to do in a positive nature? Why isn't there some payout to the kid so he can feel like he's accomplishing something? Why haven't we figured out those problems? Why are we trying to tell the kid that he shouldn't do dope? Because, you know, 90% of junk that a guy takes really doesn't actually make him feel better. It sort of just makes him feel even. So yeah. Most guys that do drugs because they're angry. They're pissed off. They are resentful. And they do them just to feel neutral. Not even good. Sometimes they feel good. Certain drugs make you feel good.
Sure.
But they really want to feel neutral, like, yes, I don't feel great, but I don't feel bad.
Right.
And that's why I'm doing it. And most of the things that people say to you, like they say things like marijuana doesn't lead to heroin addiction, you talk to any one of these guys in these drug centers, and I go, oh, no? Really? Well, that's how I started.
But that's because they're still looking for a way, you know, I mean, some people are able to just stop.
I suppose. And well, who's writing books for them? Who gives a crap about them? They're able to stop, then all you know, then they're the next door neighbor. You don't; those aren't the ones to worry
right.
about.
No, I understand.
Don't stop. So anyway, we both did this, and we both had some experience. Denny lived in Hell's Kitchen for Christ's sake, and
sure.
I was up in the Bronx, you know, running a center. So, what happened was that you know they didn't; the project just died. And so when while we're doing – and this happened before this. So what happened with the Green Lantern, Green Arrow thing I thought, well, shit, Denny knows what's going on, so I'm not going to have to, you know, proselytize to him. Why don't I just do this cover? Fuck it.
Sure.
Let's just do it, and let's see where we go from there. And if you think about it, that's what that story was about. Green Arrow deserted the kid.
Yes.
And that's what happened. And I don't think you can if you're going to boil the story down as simply as that, that's what it was about.
And again, something that informs the character and is still really being exploited today in lesser ways. Nothing as extreme as yeah. Speedy's addiction, but yeah, I mean, this is a flaw of who Oliver Queen is now.
Yep.
Which I think is again, yeah, another testament to what you guys were doing, that it's still being done today and still being
followed.
Well,
I thought it was an interesting turnaround because, you know, we started the whole series by showing the flaws of Green Lantern.
Yes, that he was out of touch.
Right. And now suddenly, oh, yeah, you know, there's no angel sitting on your shoulder, buddy. We discover that Green Arrow has got some demons.
That's very cool. Now, I've seen you obviously express an interest in getting back to Green Lantern. How about Green Arrow?
Oh, I love Green Arrow. I just did a cover for a Green Lantern book that has Green Arrow in the foreground.
Okay.
And I just don't think they... I'm never happy with it, the way anybody does Green Arrow. I think of him as like Errol Flynn with this big smile on his face, you know, and you go, God, guy's got dimples. You know, if I was a girl, I'd fuck him. You know what I mean? And I
sure.
never see that. I see this, you know, this guy looks like a, I don't know, an aristocrat or a dilettante or some weird, you know, guy that doesn't, is very confused about his own personality. I don't think he's confused at all. I think he's this big, smiling, grinning, dimpled hero with muscles that he got from working out, and he's good at what he does. So that's what I put on this cover. So maybe, you know, get one more new image of Green Arrow with a big grin on his face.
Let's get into your science, if we may, because because we've been talking, and I want to give you an opportunity to talk about this. The planet is expanding.
Oh no, it's growing.
The planet is growing.
I mean, if the planet was expanding, you could put a pin in it and pop, right?
Well, that's okay. And again, I'm a layman, so you know, and again, I would really tell people, go to your website, check out these videos, because
yeah, I think you sort of have to do that to get a sense
yes.
of it, because it seems extreme when you say it in words, because you've been fed so much. Well, I don't want to say the words propaganda. You've been fed so much stuff about what they call tectonics.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you've been told for the last 40 years. Those of you who are old enough, those who are younger, have been told it all their lives, that what happened was all the continents were all together in one big giant island on one side of the Earth, and mm-hmm. the Earth is about the size that it is today. And what happened was those continents broke apart and spread around the world. Now, if you're curious or easily annoyed, it might occur to you that if you were to take all that water off, that those continents all together on this one big giant island were sort of like a planted into the undersea plate like a tree root is planted in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have to wonder how they broke apart and spread around the Earth. How did they do that? You know, it's not like, you know, they had these little picnic ants from Warner Brothers, you know, lifting up the continents and, you know, marching across the planet and planting it somewhere else.
Sure.
So you sort of have to have some kind of a reasonable rationale for believing that. But when I first saw this theory presented 40 years ago, I thought, gee, you know, that's an odd-looking planet there. It's got one big giant island on one side, and then three-quarters of the planet is ocean 5 miles deep. Who made this planet? I mean, this looks like an eyeball, you know?
Sure.
An iris there in the front, and the rest of it is water,
mm-hmm.
5 miles. It doesn't seem like you... I can understand, you can imagine how the continents were together. You look at the Atlantic, and it looks like South America fits into Africa, and you can kind of see the other way the other stuff fits together. So you can see how this idea might occur to somebody, and then you can see how they could scientifically investigate the tectonic levels and how they break apart, and then you could study the animals and you could study the plants on each of the different continents. Say, oh, same plants are in Europe that are in North America. Same plants are in Africa that are in South America. Oh, yeah, so they were once contiguous and they joined together. You could come to that conclusion because that does make a kind of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd then have to ignore the other conclusion. And the other conclusion would be, well, what if the Earth was smaller? And not only did everything join in the Atlantic, but it also joined in the Pacific. It basically was one big ancient covering of a smaller Earth, and that the Earth just kind of grew, and all those continents broke apart, because, of course, if the inside grows, then the continents, the surface, the crust has to crack apart,
right.
And those pieces just kind of stayed where they are. The planet just got bigger, and in between you had these rifting, spreading areas that the water fell off the continents and drained into those areas, and as Earth created more matter, presumably on the inside, it created more water, and now you have the oceans. Now, that would mean a whole bunch of things. For example, it would have to mean that in the days of the dinosaurs, when all those continents were supposedly together, that the Earth was smaller.
Mm-hmm.
That would mean that the gravity was a lot less. So you could support animals that were 5 times the size of animals today, like the sauropods. Oh, that sort of fits there. Hmm. because a sauropod is about five times the weight of an elephant. An elephant can just barely walk.
Sure.
So how could you have a creature that's five times that size without its guts kind of crushing themselves? Doesn't even make sense. And what about the idea of measuring the tectonics of all the continents in the Pacific? Did anybody do that? Funny, nobody did that. Wonder why? Well, because they figured that in the Atlantic, since they all came together, they couldn't possibly come together in the Pacific, right? Yeah, unless you, you know, actually do the work and check, and then you'd find that they did. Oh, well, that's not so good. Wait a second. So anyway, about 40 years ago, a couple of geologists said, and I'm watching this, you know, because I'm a fan of science. You know, mm-hmm. Anything that comes on, you could just sit me in front of the TV and hit me with a hammer. I won't turn away. A couple of scientists came on and said, actually, we think that the Earth grew. Actually, all the geology seems to support the idea that the Earth grew and that the surface just spread apart and the continents actually don't move around like bumper cars and crash into one another. Oh, well, so, there's common sense. You know, somebody's making some sense here. Okay, that made Neil happy because I can see that. That's good, okay? And then some other scientists and the other rest of the scientific community said, well, wait a second. How does Earth grow? Excuse me. Sir, idiot. You're saying that the Earth grew here. You'd have to prove that the Earth grew. Now, I didn't realize it at the time, but the reason that those guys couldn't prove that the Earth grew because they didn't know.
Right.
That's kind of bad. Not only didn't they know, they actually couldn't know because they were geologists. You see, they were smart geologists, and they figured out how this whole thing worked. But from a physics point of view, they had no answer.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was the rest of the scientific community, including physicists and all the rest of it, said, you're idiots. You don't know what you're talking about. And you're wrong. Prove that you are right, and we'll accept it. Well, they couldn't. They weren't physicists. They were geologists. And the problem with science, to me, and has been the problem for ages, and that is that scientists specialize. They didn't used to. You know, when Newton was around, he studied everything.
Right, right.
But now everybody studies one thing,
mm-hmm.
and they study it ad infinitum. They study it totally. They know everything, and it's so much to know. In fact, there's so much to know that you haven't got time to study all the rest of this stuff. So there was no, you know, you go down the hall and you get Fred the physicist and say, Fred, I got a problem here. These guys are attacking me. I have to show that the Earth grew. You know, they're not going to do that because the guy down the hall is another geologist.
Right.
So they don't get together. And the physicist, if you tap a physicist, he goes, what am I trying to prove here? What? That the Earth grew? Look, I have other things to do, you know. I'm involved in physics and molecular, you know, shit. I want to see how many mm-hmm. quarks there are in a proton.
Sure.
And so they're not interested. But you see, if that was a clue to how all physics worked, they wouldn't know that because the geologist can't put it in terms that they understand. So what if a geologist could go to a physicist or a room full of physicists and say, look, start from this premise, the Earth grew. Well, the physicist would say, and then you'd have to pull in a couple of cosmologists because the thinking would have to be a little bit broader.
Yes.
They would say, well, wait a second, if the Earth grew, then what you'd be saying is that all planets grow.
Right.
Oh, am I saying that? I was just trying to prove the Earth grew. No. If the Earth grew, all planets would have to grow. You'd have to be able to see signs on all planets that all planets grew. In fact, all moons would have to grow. You almost mm-hmm. have to prove that meteorites grow. You can't do that. And then you'd have to prove that suns grow. Well, actually, you know, our sun does grow.
Yes.
It doesn't grow in a way that you think, you see, because you're just geologists. We'll explain it to you. Because we have 17 different explanations as to why the sun grows, and you can pick any one that you want. So you'd have to show, but you know that what that would mean is, actually, that means that, galaxies grow, and, that would mean the universe grows, and, but we have a, you see, we have this Big Bang Theory that explains that, but what you're saying is that the universe grows, so we'd have to take the Big Bang Theory and throw that away, because you're basically saying it's growing, not exploding, and that would be a different explanation than we have now, and, that would be giving up a lot. You sure you want to say this? And the geologist would go, I guess not. I'm just trying to prove that the Earth grew. Well, it actually does kind of lead to a new science, because then you'd be saying that matter can be created. That would mean that there'd have to be a pre-matter, like a dark matter. Of course, this would be 40 years ago. It has to be a pre-matter, right, like dark matter, and that you make matter out of it, and you'd have to make it like inside the core of the Earth, inside the core of a sun. inside a moon, and, well, that actually makes sense. And then you'd be saying that a solar system grows, you know, planets would be getting bigger, Jupiter would be getting bigger, and it would be, that would actually explain why there aren't so many meteorites hitting the Earth anymore and hitting Mars anymore. Instead of saying that there weren't, there are fewer meteorites, you'd just be saying that Jupiter getting bigger is attracting them, becoming a an umbrella for us.
Okay.
Well, that sort of makes sense. After a while, that does actually, could be a whole theory here. Nah, forget it. We're not talking. We got other things to do.
Is there that much resistance still?
Oh, sure.
I mean, you know, it's...
I don't think there's any resistance. I think there's very few people presenting this point of view. The leading character I found out a couple of years ago was a guy named Samuel Warren Carey in Australia, who at that time was one of those people and who was ostracized, but became a powerful geologist, but he, to his dying day, which was about 2 years ago, insisted that the theory was correct, that subduction doesn't exist, which I haven't explained to you,
mm-hmm.
and that it's preposterous to think that the Earth remained the same size when all the continents clearly fit together, and if you made a globe, you could show how they fit together, and that would be impossible unless it were true. You couldn't possibly put the continents together so that they fit exactly and perfectly, because that would be a little too much of a coincidence, according to Sherlock Holmes. So,
and no one's picked up. This was 40 years ago, I'm assuming, that he made these points.
Yeah.
And there
are people, various people around. There are a couple of organizations that get together and try to prove this. But you see, the big stumbling block is they don't bring in the physicists. And because they don't have a theory that explains how the Earth can grow. So what you have is you have different people saying, well, actually what happens is all the atoms in the universe expand after the Big Bang. And then you have people who say, well, it's actually accretion. It's meteorites coming to the Earth and building up, which is another stupid concept. You need somebody who's willing to accept the geology, study the geology, and then study the physics, study the cosmology, study the paleontology, and study all those other sciences that show this. Who would that be? I can't even imagine. Let me see. Some comic book artist. Some guy who's got time on his hands, who's willing to read all the books that everybody else reads, and willing to speak English and to avoid all that math and all the rest of it, and just talk science and get involved in this and figure out what the hell happened. Is there a theory that explains it? Guess what? There is one.
Well, is beyond, you know, your circles, which would include, you know, even talking to me right now and stuff, is there an avenue that you can take beyond that?
If there was, I'd be on it. I mean, I'm writing a book. You already know that you've seen parts of my video.
Yes.
2 hours long. I can certainly distribute it in comic book stores, and I've told a lot of people about it, but after all, who am I talking to? I'm talking to comic book fans.
Right.
I did the Superman, I did that cover for ESPN magazine. It went to 3 million subscribers of ESPN magazine. How many of those are comic book fans? I guess 5.
Well, you were, and Wired at least covered your theory to a degree.
They covered the thing, and they fucked with me.
But they did.
It's cool.
I mean, well, yeah, and you're right. And the quote that I remember is, you know, Einstein was an unaccredited man with a scientific theory, but so was Eric von Däniken, who is the Chariots of the Gods guy.
I see. The thing is that I'm on exactly the right road to be right or be whack. I mean, just as good a chance of being whack as I am being right. The thing about it is that I view things in percentages. Like I've been through, in my lifetime, I've been through certain events, like the drug addiction center in the Bronx,
mm-hmm.
What's happened to me in comic books, and I know that there's a lot of stuff that's out there that's bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You can you know, you have to really raise your head high to get above a lot of the bullshit. In comic books, they were printing with the wrong paper. They were printing with the wrong inks. They were printing with the wrong color process. They were printing with the wrong colors. They were doing everything wrong. And for me to stay in comic books caused me to say, okay, I'm going to have to repair all this stuff, and I'm going to have to do it from the inside. Nobody's going to actually going to be able to know that I'm doing it while I'm doing it. I'm going to have to destroy the comics code. I'm going to have to do all these things, and everybody's going to go, he's just crazy. And in the end, it'll come out the way it ought to be, and we will be in a new time when comic books will be recognized. Okay, so I'm used to doing that. I get it. Okay, it's just a job, you know, for me. It's just a job. destroying and rebuilding science, that's another job.
Sure.
And there's a lot of science that's great. 90%, probably 99% of science is great.
Okay.
There's some really bad theories out there that cause other theories that cause other theories. For example, 150 years ago, scientists, not scientists, but philosophers and scientists, people who were talking about science, really weren't scientists, said in a group, together or apart, they said, well, this is the way that it works. This is how we make a solar system. You got all this shit floating around, okay? It's all rocks and all this stuff floating around. Along comes gravity, and it spins this stuff and allows this stuff to collect into moons and suns and planets. And that's how you get the solar system.
Right.
Now, that's 150 years ago. I'm tapping on the door of science and going, guys, that was 150 years ago. Somebody thought a lot of crap was floating around, you see?
Yep.
But out in space, there's not a lot of crap floating around. Because if there was a lot of crap floating around, gravity would have pulled it together a long time ago.
Sure.
You see? Because that's what gravity does.
Yep.
It doesn't allow all this stuff to collect and to fill up this big space, and then it comes along and puts it together. It starts putting it together right at the beginning. So the logic is, it didn't have a lot of stuff. However gravity worked, however it worked, the theory is wrong. Now what you're doing is, you're now saying, okay, Earth started the same size as it is today, 5 billion years ago. A whole bunch of stuff collected into the Earth, because it was all laying around.
Right.
Okay, now we had the Earth the size it is today, and because it all collected like that, it was molten, and all the iron melted and it went to the center of the Earth, and now we have the Earth the way it is today. No. No. That's not it. There wasn't a lot of stuff floating around. There might have been a lot of hydrogen, because probably if you take dark matter or pre-matter or whatever it is, and you start making matter out of it, you're pretty much only going to get hydrogen, because it don't even have neutrons. It's just got electrons and protons. It's the simplest form of matter.
Okay.
Okay? So you're going to make a whole lot of hydrogen. And the only thing you can make from hydrogen is sun. So
right,
the logic
right.
is you got a whole lot of hydrogen, and then you have gravity working on it, you're going to get a sun. If you want to get anything else, you got to figure out a way to get that sun to make all the rest of it. Because that's all you got. You don't have planets with rocks and irons and calcium and sulfur and all the rest of this stuff. All you have is hydrogen. And what hydrogen will do under the right conditions, it'll make helium. And then it'll stop. You can't have iron. You can't have all the rest. So how do you get that stuff? In other words, what's the process that that has to go through to get all these higher atoms that now float around in our solar system? Didn't happen the way we described it 150 years ago. That's ridiculous. It's childish. Drop it. Now figure out a real process. You know, you're scientists. Forget all that crap. Now figure it out. Start with hydrogen. And that's already a big jump.
Yeah.
So if that's how it happened, or something relating to that in some kind of simple way, then the process that brought us to where we are today was a process that is nothing like that other process, that silly, childish, stupid process. It's something else. We got to go from hydrogen to what we have today. How do we get there? It don't start with full-blown planets. It doesn't make sense. Something, some other processes had to take place. And there are, as it turns out, some real simple processes that do that. In fact, if you want to study just a little bit of it, look up Carl David Anderson, the youngest man to win the Nobel Prize in 1932. He experimented with nothing, and he got something. Anyway, the thing is that what's happened is that we have this history of crap, just like in comics. You know, I walk into Sol Harrison's office, and I say, Sol, DC Comics only has 32 colors. Yeah? Well, Marvel Comics has 64 colors. They have twice as many colors. Well, that's because they have tone yellow. Yeah, that's true. Mathematically, if you got tone yellow and you have 25% and 50% of tone yellow, you're going to get 64 colors. Why don't we have it? It's too expensive. No, Sol. No, I don't think so. Because the same people that do the separations for Marvel do the separations for DC. So that means that Marvel's paying more for separations than DC is. I don't think that's true. You don't know what you're talking about. Get out of my office. Fuck you. Okay. What do we do with this? Let me see. I'm going to get twice as many colors. A little too tempting to resist. Go into Joe Kubert's office and say, Joe, you know, Marvel gets twice as many colors as we do. No. Yeah, really. You think Jack Leibowitz would like that? I don't think so. Maybe you ought to tell him. Hey, wait a second. Let me see that chart. Okay, here's the chart, Joe. Here's the colors we get because we get tone yellow. We don't get tone yellow? No. That's why we have pink skin on everybody. Oh. And here's the other colors on the rest of the chart because of the tone yellow. I'm going to show this to Jack. Goes to talk to Jack. Jack comes out, goes into Sol Harrison's office. What the hell is going on here? Martin Goodman has twice as many colors as we have. That cheap SOB has twice as many colors as we have. I don't believe it. Find out what's going on. Okay, boss. So, John, how much more would it cost us to get tone yellow? Okay. Yeah, thanks. Do that. Have fun. So he can give us the tone yellow. What's it going to cost? Nothing. Okay, fine. I knew that guy, that cheap, that wouldn't be paying more money than we are. Down the hall. 14-second conversation, I'm reckoning. Double the number of colors that DC Comics gets. Doubled.
And that's why you went back and recolored a lot of your first...
Well, now we get computer colors. We got millions of colors.
Do you want to go back, George Lucas, and even do more?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I want to go back. You know what I want to do? I want to go back and get the Jack Kirby, Wally Wood Challenges of the Unknown and recolor them.
That's cool.
That would be great.
Absolutely.
And, you know, if people don't like it, they can go out and buy the old comic book.
That's true.
You know, they're out there. You can buy them for you fanatics. They exist. But if you really want to see Jack Kirby and Wally Wood modernized, you know, brought up to date and something you can be proud of, ought to be done. There's lots of projects like that. It would be really nifty.
See, and again, that's I had this written in my notes as well. That's what I like about your science. It is exactly like your view of the business of comics. You came in, you saw what the status quo is, and said, you know, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
It's just as
and not because I'm saying it. You know, some things are just self-evident. You know?
But you had the perception to say, well, wait a minute, this just doesn't make sense. And again, not to be an asshole, you're just trying to, hey, I don't get this. Why is A the right way when B is so clearly the better way?
Exactly. And you know, people say, well, you're just being a jerk, you're just being an asshole. At a certain point, you kind of go, well, okay, fine, I'll take the label because I can't avoid it. But really, honestly, guys, it would be better if we do it this way. Like, you can't bleed the pages. Why can't you bleed the pages? Well, because one page prints into the next page, and then that page, the artwork will appear on the other page. Well, that really actually doesn't make sense, but I've seen magazines printed, and they do these eight-page maquette. My understanding is that a machine comes down at the end of the printing line and trims the edges off, because otherwise the edges won't fit together. So they have to trim off a certain percentage. Now, if you trim off an eighth of an inch of one page and you trim off an eighth of an inch of another page, then that's a quarter of an inch of trim. So you can bleed the page and you can just trim it off. No, it doesn't work that way. I really think it does, guys. What's Neil doing? He's bleeding his pages. They're going to get into print on the next page. He doesn't think so. We'll show him. Oh, they bleed. I guess we can all do it now.
Unbelievable.
Yes, we can all do it now.
Wow.
Who is this asshole? God, what a troublemaker.
Damn you, Neil.
Can't print over 200% of a color on anything. Why is that so? Well, because what'll happen is you get a layering of ink, and if you get 200% of a color, it wets the paper too much, and the paper slides on the press. So we're printing on toilet paper. I mean, if I worked at Newsweek magazine, you get that nice slick paper, I'd go, maybe. But this is like, this will suck ink dry in a nanosecond. It's toilet paper.
Yeah.
Well, during the war, during the war. Okay, you mean World War II, right? Yes, during the war we could. Yeah, well, you know, during the war you used all kinds of different paper there, Sol, but, you know, now we just use newsprint.
Yep.
Well, no, you just don't do that. doing it in this book. So that's going to slide. It's going to slide. I'm telling you, it's going to slide. You're going to see it. You're going to see the whole impression. Okay? All right. Well, okay, I'll go with that.
When you were running continuity then, and when, or I should say you're still running continuity, obviously,
yeah.
when continuity was publishing books.
If I wasn't, I shouldn't be on this phone this long.
Well, thanks for sneaking in an office and taking my call. But when you were writing, when you were producing your own books and stuff, were you using a lot of these techniques? I mean, did you?
Sure.
Were you doing more things there than
blue line techniques, all kinds of stuff? Yeah, sure. Yeah, we did everything. If you look at the Death Watch 2000 stuff, we printed on indestructible paper.
Okay.
You know that I don't know if you know it, but there's this. Paper that they use for Federal Express packages.
Okay.
We printed on that.
Wow.
You can't rip it.
Oh, that's wild.
Couldn't rip the comic.
That's amazing.
Try to destroy this comic book. You can't.
Was that on the cover?
Huh?
Was that on the cover?
Oh, no, it didn't. But we promoted it that way, Indestructible Comics. And, you know, sure enough, some guy would send me a ripped in half comic. I ripped your comic in half. God damn it. Okay, Samson, anything you say, go down to the Federal Express office and show them how strong you are. But we did, we burnt holes in our covers and to make a design by using laser burning.
Mm-hmm.
And we did all kinds. We did holograms.
Yes.
And we actually cut out one of our comic books that in the shape and drew within the shape.
Wow.
So it was a regular comic book. We did a lot of things. And I like the holographic stuff because it's so cool. Such good science.
Is the market not right for bringing back some of these continuity characters? Or
it's sort of getting right. It's getting righter, and I think that's probably what we're going to do. We'll probably start off with some reprints of stuff.
Okay.
And, because since Continuity Comics, computer coloring has come in.
Yes.
And has really made a difference. So I'm experimenting with the computer coloring on the reprint books that DC is doing. And now that I see, you know, what we can do, then I'm going to do that on some of our old books. And I started a series called Rise of Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And Rise of Magic was a really great series. But what happened was that we ran into this, that insane collector's market where the collectors were buying.
Of course.
Buying boxes of comic books and putting them in their garages, and then one day they woke up one morning and said, "Are we insane?"
Yeah.
And then they stopped. And then you'd go to comic book stores and you'd see comic books piled up, $2
yep.
comic books piled, sold for 50 cents
yep.
in the front of the store. Well, we got kind of caught in that, and I thought, well, unless Warner Brothers is going to come over and finance us, or we're going to go on the stock market, I think Neil is going to pull his little comic books back and do some more advertising, because we did great on Death Watch 2000, but I'm not gonna go into bankruptcy for a principal here if it doesn't make any sense. So we pulled back, and we've sort of been waiting for the time that we come back. And I'm coming back slowly, not as a publisher so much as, you know, I've got some sketchbooks that I published
yes.
that are out, and I'm doing some stuff for DC and for Marvel, you know, just kind of, you know, testing the waters and seeing what's going on. We've still been working on the Rise of Magic stuff. Quietly on the side. And I think I'm going to be doing a six-part series of Batman for DC Comics.
Terrific.
And they're coming up with some actually very nice. And but meanwhile, you know, I've been fighting for various things. Like, you notice that the Batman books that are out there have my name at the top. It's Neil Adams Batman.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm getting a royalty for that because I'm getting a royalty for the use of my name. So if there's any of you creators out there that are listening to this and they're putting your name on the cover, you deserve a royalty for it.
Very cool.
By the way, just a little stab at the companies there.
Well, and I saw your piece, too, of Paul Levitt shaking your hand in regards to the Batman film.
That was pretty nice, wasn't it?
Very nice.
I would say excellent. I would say that's a turnabout there. It's too bad that Marvel isn't doing it.
Yeah, that was going to be my thought. Can you take yourself out of that and say whether you like the X-Men films or not? I mean, obviously, they're very successful.
No,
but
no. Well, it's a little hard for me to say I'm not liking what I'm seeing these days. I mean, the plot element of the first X-Men film was Magneto makes a machine that turns human beings into mutants.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that part of the 10-issue miniseries that I did
mm-hmm.
where Magneto is down in the Forbidden Land and he's turning creatures into mutants?
Sure.
Hard for me not to like that.
No,
but when the writer comes up and says, you know, that's yours. And the writers for the new Batman movie come up and say, you know, that's yours. Yeah.
Well, and DC, I guess, did right by you.
Yeah. I think probably I deserve more, but there you
sure.
go. I think I'm not going to complain since there's no agreement.
Well, there you go. Yeah, no, I understand that. And obviously you've got a good enough relationship with Paul Levitz that you are coming back to Batman and stuff. How are things with Marvel?
I'm doing a few little things for Marvel, but I find perhaps they're treating me nicer than they're treating people that they should be treating well. For example, Dave Cockrum. We had a bit of a hassle with Dave Cockrum's work that they still haven't come up to the bar and treated him properly on.
Definitely.
And it does bother me. DC Comics is paying royalties to Jack Kirby's family, but Marvel is not.
Yeah.
In fact, 5 years after Jack's death, they cut off royalties. That's not a very nice thing.
No.
If an artist has a character they created in the X-Men, let's say, and they have an agreement that they're to receive money if a movie gets made on the character, then you would say, being just a regular human being and not getting involved in the, you know, that esoteric crap that they call the legal system, where they might say to that artist or creator, well, the X-Men is about the X-Men. It's not about your character, the one that you created. So if we do a movie about your character specifically, we'll give you a royalty. But since it's the X-Men and your character is simply included, we're not going to give you a royalty. You would say, being a person, you would say, well, then why don't you just count the X-Men that are in the movie and break up that percentage among those people?
Sure.
That would be reasonable.
Sure.
And as a human, you would say that would be a good solution. But since they have lawyers over there, they don't have to do that.
No.
And unless the person objects and sues them, they'll never have to do it. Whether that's ethical or fair, I think that's the question, and you know it's not. Not because I say so. I don't think you really have to get too complicated when it comes to ethics and fairness to know that that's wrong. I think that DC, on the other hand, without any agreement, has stepped forward and said, hey, we recognize that you guys made a contribution to this, and therefore we're going to give you some money. I think that's ethical and fair. I mean, to me, the world isn't really terribly complicated. I don't believe that the legal system was created to be an epitome of ethics, fairness, or honor. I think it's just the goddamn legal system. Take it, the God part out, because I don't think it ought to be associated that closely with this. I think that it's a very bad system. And very often, even when we write fiction, we talk about how you bypass that system in order to be fair to people. That's a whole raft of literature. Well, it's a whole raft of life, too. It's true that the legal system and lawyers and the way they conduct themselves are not very fair and ethical. But that's just an opinion.
Shared by many. I really, again, encourage people to check out neiladams.com, and you can, you know, read a little bit more into some of the subjects that we're talking about, especially the one you just discussed. Go check it out. You'll see a lot of evidence of what's going on currently with Neil, his scientific interests and pursuits.
And if you want to prove to friends that Neil Adams is crazy, you go to that site and you'll be able to do it.
But it'll answer a lot of your questions in terms of things that you might not have heard covered in this interview. Your time has been great, Neil. I truly appreciate it.
A pleasure.
And that'll do it for this special holiday edition of WordBalloon.com. Thanks a lot for listening. Make sure you come back to the site and keep checking for more updates on new interviews. This is John Suntress. Have a great holiday season. WordBalloon is a copyrighted feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2005.